Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. A suicide bomber blew himself up in a Shiite mosque in eastern Saudi Arabia Friday, killing at least 19 people. The Islamic State militant group claimed responsibility for the attack, which comes amid mounting Sunni-Shiite sectarian tensions across the Arab world due to conflicts in Iraq, Syria, and Yemen. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Amateur video showed Saudi rescue workers arriving at the Imam Ali Shiite Mosque in Qatif as worshippers mulled around the entrance to the building and victims of the blast were being carried out. Pictures posted on social media showed injured or dead victims in blood-soaked clothes being taken to ambulances parked outside. Saudi Grand Mufti Abdulaziz Al-Sheikh, the country's top religious leader, told Saudi TV that the attackers were trying to inflame sectarian tensions. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Rights group Amnesty International says it has gathered overwhelming evidence that Ukrainian forces, pro-government militias, and anti-government separatists have tortured or mistreated prisoners, describing it as widespread and frequent. Amnesty released a report Friday detailing information from interviews with former captives of both the separatists and government forces. It said accounts of detainee torture are as commonplace as they are shocking. Amnesty called on Ukrainian authorities to investigate all allegations of war crimes and other abuses and bring to justice those responsible. This is VOA News. President Barack Obama has reaffirmed the U.S. commitment to Israel's security, speaking at one of Washington's largest Jewish synagogues Friday. Mr. Obama stressed that his administration is committed to preventing Iran from developing a nuclear weapon.
The deal that we already reached with Iran has already halted or rolled back parts of Iran's nuclear program. Now we're seeking a comprehensive solution. I will not accept a bad deal. This deal will have my name on it, so nobody has a bigger personal stake in making sure that it delivers on its promise.
The president said he wants a deal that imposes unprecedented inspections on all aspects of Iran's nuclear program to detect any cheating. He also outlined his administration's response to the resurgence of anti-Semitism in Europe. An outbreak of cholera has killed 29 Burundian refugees who fled to Tanzania to escape political unrest at home. The UN Refugee Agency said Friday that two Tanzanians have also died in an outbreak that has affected 3,000 people in the Kangunga area near Lake Tanganyika. Officials have brought in clean water, medicine, and other supplies to halt the outbreak. Meanwhile, anti-government protests continued in Burundi's capital Friday. VOA's Central Africa Service reports demonstrators tried to gather in central Bujumbura, but were blocked by police. U.S. federal prosecutors have charged the chairman of Temple University's physics department in connection with an alleged scheme to provide sensitive technology to China. Xi Xiaojing, a naturalized U.S. citizen who was born in China, is facing charges of wire fraud. Prosecutors have accused the 47-year-old of seeking prestigious appointments in China in exchange for providing data on electronics technology invented by a U.S. company. She faces up to 80 years in prison and a $1 million fine if convicted. A key measure of U.S. inflation shows consumer prices rose 0.1% in April as falling energy costs were offset by rising prices for shelter and medical care. Friday's report from the Bureau of Labor Statistics said prices gained 0.3% in the overall economy, excluding the food and energy sectors where prices are often more volatile. A senior U.S. diplomat says Myanmar's Muslim Rohingya, who have been fleeing poverty and persecution in the country, should have a path to citizenship as a way to help solve the current humanitarian crisis in the region. The uncertainty that comes with not having any status is one of the things that may drive people to leave, said U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken. I'm Bob Doty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Yiswuhib. And coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight...
The situation is difficult. Neighboring countries are keeping their borders open, and we're very grateful for that. And it's very important that refugees are able to seek a refuge outside their country. We heard about some obstacles in Burundi itself.
That's Karine de Grey of the UNHCR commenting on the humanitarian crisis in Burundi. Details next.
Also in the news, the UN says 30,000 people have fled intensified fighting in northern Mali over the past 2 weeks.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Rwanda, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, political demonstrations are expanding in Burundi. Protesters today spread into the center of Bujumbura and south of the capital to Mukiki province. Reports say they set fire to June 5th election materials and blocked a truck carrying election boots. Another day of defying a presidential ban on demonstrations, other protesters blew whistles and crowded into the capital's Sibitoki and Mutakura districts despite an increased police presence. The protesters oppose a third term for President Pierre Nkurunziza. No casualties have been reported today. The Burundi Red Cross says that yesterday two protesters were shot and killed by police in Musaga district. At the time, demonstrators threw stones over burning barricades at police. Red Cross authorities say police replied with tear gas and automatic weapons. Reporters were blocked from entering Musaga today. In other news on Burundi, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has released a statement saying he is encouraged by the ongoing dialogue in the country. He says it involves representatives of government, civil society, political parties, religious organizations, the AU, and the UN. However, Mr. Ban says he is very concerned about the growing humanitarian crisis of Burundian refugees in neighboring countries.
Well, nearly 100,000 people have fled political turmoil, violence, and intimidation in Burundi. As part of a growing humanitarian crisis, they've sought refuge in neighboring Rwanda, Tanzania, and the DRC. As a result, today, the UNHCR and its partners are appealing for $207 million for a regional response plan to protect and assist the refugees. The UNHCR says their numbers are expected to double over the next 6 months. Karine de Grey is a spokesperson for the UNHCR in Geneva. She spoke with me about the situation on the ground.
We have now nearly 100,000 Burundian refugees who have fled the country since early April. They've come mostly to Rwanda and Tanzania, and smaller numbers to the Democratic Republic of the Congo, but also further afield in Uganda.
How are the neighboring countries dealing with the influx of refugees?
The situation is difficult. Neighboring countries are keeping their borders open, and we're very grateful for that. And it's very important that refugees are able to seek a refuge outside their country. We heard about some obstacles in Burundi itself. So we're very grateful that neighboring countries keep their borders open, but the situation is very difficult, particularly in Tanzania, where people have for a long time in a small village that was difficult to reach. We have now started moving people out of that village into refugee settlements. The situation is slowly improving.
Outside of fleeing from the political turmoil and violence, what other obstacles are Burundians facing in Burundi right now?
The refugees tell us that they are facing intimidation and threats, but they've also reported to us roadblocks and militia armed groups that are preventing them from leaving or are trying to get money, extort them for money. And it makes it very difficult if refugees need to cross 5 or 6 roadblocks at a time. Every time they are being bribed, it's difficult for many of them to leave the country. They're also being threatened. So some of them come with terrible stories about threats and threatened of being raped. So those are the kind of stories that we are hearing of.
What is their health condition once they flee to a neighboring country?
We have a very serious situation right now in Tanzania. You might have seen the reports of a cholera outbreak in Kagunga, the place that I mentioned to you earlier. That's why it's so important to step up efforts to move people out and get cholera into Kagunga and in the transit centers and the refugee camps where people are. It's really important that these people are being treated within the first 2 days to avoid dehydration. So that's the situation in Tanzania. The other neighboring countries, there's no such epidemic and are stepping up efforts to move refugees to sites, to a refugee camp where there will be a range of health, sanitation and other facilities that are usually available to refugees in such settings.
You all are appealing for $207 million to respond to this Burundi refugee emergency. How will the money be used? And I understand that it is to go through September of this year.
Yes, it's a 6-month regional refugee response plan covering Rwanda, Tanzania, Uganda and the Democratic Republic of the Congo. We fear that given the situation in Burundi, by the end of these 6 months, there might be up to 200,000 refugees. At this moment, we're talking about 100,000. So that's what we're planning for. That's not the situation we have now. Our immediate priorities is clean drinking water, transportation of refugees, registration, shelter, and health services.
Karen Ducret is a spokesperson for the UNHCR. She spoke with me from Geneva.
The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs reports nearly 30,000 people have fled intensified fighting in northern Mali over the past 2 weeks. The agency says the displaced are in urgent need of humanitarian assistance. Lisa Schlein reports from OCHA headquarters in Geneva.
Sporadic fighting is a way of life in Mali's turbulent northern region, but the United Nations is alarmed at the recent increase in violence in small villages surrounding the city of Timbuktu. A spokesman for the UN's humanitarian office, Jens Laerke, says armed groups and individuals have attacked and displaced thousands of civilians, looted their houses, and pillaged their shops and livestock.
Our partners and local authorities on the ground estimate that over the past 2 weeks, nearly 27,000 people have fled their homes and villages. And in the past week alone, 20,000 people have been uprooted by this violence. The displaced people are currently staying in temporary shelters or with host families in the larger population hubs in the region or on the south bank of the Niger River. They are in urgent need of water, food, non-food items, and emergency shelter.
Tuareg separatist rebels have been fighting for an independent state from Mali for decades. The last civil war, which erupted between the rebels and government in January 2012, became particularly vicious and destructive after Islamist groups affiliated with Al-Qaeda joined the fray. The legacy of that brutal war lingers on. While 400,000 have returned to the homes they fled in the north, tens of thousands of others remain internally displaced, and around 135,000 are still in exile as refugees in neighboring countries. The United Nations has appealed for $377 million to provide humanitarian assistance this year to 1.5 million people. In mid-May, the government and Tuareg rebels signed a preliminary agreement to end the war. Many people fear this latest flare-up of fighting could doom the fragile peace process. Laerke tells VOA a mixture of armed individuals, including pro-government militia, Tuareg separatists, and criminals out for personal gain, are wreaking havoc in the region around Timbuktu.
It has been simmering for a very long time, but this is clearly a spike, a surge in violence that we have seen in the past couple of weeks. Why this is happening? Well, that is a history of, I think, 40 or 50 years of Tuareg separatist movement and so on and so forth. It's a very complex pattern of various layers of conflicts up there. But the humanitarian outcome is pretty clear. This is what we are seeing. Nearly 30,000 people displaced in the span of just a couple of weeks.
Lierke says humanitarian organizations in the region are pre-positioning relief items and have begun distributing food aid. He says assessment of needs is ongoing, but insecurity is making this difficult. He says the most dangerous area to access is the district of Gorma Rarus, where more than 15,000 of the displaced are reportedly scattered in different locations. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Kenyan officials say fighters from militant group Al-Shabaab attacked a village in northeastern Kenya last night, but were pushed back by security forces after a brief gun battle. For VOA, Mohammed Yusuf reports.
In a press statement issued Friday, Kenya's Interior Ministry said it has thwarted an attack on a small village in Garissa County. Interior Ministry spokesman Mwenda Njoka tells VOA that Somalia-based group Al-Shabaab was behind the trouble.
Some suspected Al-Shabaab militias attempted to attack a village in Ijara,
he says. Members of the public alerted security and action was taken to ensure there was no casualties. Kenyan media reports say the militants had been in the area for 5 days. Witnesses and residents say that after the gun battle, some of the assailants were still in the area and could be planning more attacks. Njoka says Kenyan forces are positioned to protect the population.
We have security forces on the ground, but we have not gotten any details.
We have forces on the ground. We don't have specific details where they are right now, Njoka says. He also says that after security forces moved in, the militants blended into the population. They know the area, he says, and some may try to hide in the community. The attack comes just 2 days after Al-Shabaab fighters stormed a mosque in a nearby village, giving summons and reading the names of those working with the government in various departments, including security. Al-Shabaab militants took control of Garissa University College last month in a drone attack, taking a number of hostages inside university buildings. By the time the siege was over, 148 people were dead, most of them students. Al-Shabaab has vowed to continue such attacks while Kenya has troops stationed in Somalia, supporting the Somali government in its fight against the militants. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib, 18 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Political demonstrations are expanding in Burundi. The UN says 30,000 people have fled intensified fighting in northern Mali over the past 2 weeks. And Kenyan officials say fighters from the militant group Al-Shabaab have attacked a village in northeastern Kenya. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
Ethiopia often describes the country as a developmental democracy and its policy as revolutionary democracy. But opponents question what these policies mean and say the country is not enjoying much democracy or development at all. Martha van der Wolf has more from Addis Ababa.
The Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Democratic Front has governed Ethiopia for the past 24 years. For most of that time, the party has promoted the ideologies known as revolutionary democracy and developmental democracy. Under these policies, the country has experienced double-digit economic growth after the grueling famine of the mid-1980s. Redwan Hussein is a government spokesman and also used to head the ruling party's secretariat. He explains what officials mean by revolutionary democracy.
You can opt for democracy to be built evolutionary, gradually. You could also opt for a democracy which must be built revolutionarily, radically. All the system, all the thinking must be changed, root and branch, completely, and fast. So this is revolutionary.
According to the government, developmental democracy means there will be no development without democracy or democracy without development. Hallelujah Luli of the Institute of Security Studies says there is a built-in tension between the two ideologies.
But the government in developmental states or in democratic developmental state, the role of the government in the economy and the public life, it will decrease through time. But in revolutionary democracy, it will increase through time. So that's the difference between the two, in my interpretation.
Ethiopia's economy is managed through five-year plans aimed at making Ethiopia a middle-income country by the mid-2020s. In Addis Ababa, the development is very noticeable, with many new roads, high buildings, an elevated railway, and many condominiums to provide housing for the masses. But two of the bigger opposition parties, Medrek and Blue Party, are critical of the ideological terms and their meaning. They contest the idea that Sunday's election will be democratic, saying they face intimidation and harassment by the police and ruling party supporters. And despite the impressive growth numbers, thousands of Ethiopians leave the country every month, hoping to find better lives in the Middle East or Europe. Medrek chairman Beyene Petros says the development is not affecting the larger population, as 85% of Ethiopians live in rural areas.
I'm a first generation moving into an urban setting. So the population that I knew 50 years ago, just living the same kind of life, scratching the land, using the same plow. The difference is the piece of land which they used to hold, which was much, you know, larger, has now shrunk to literally about one-tenth because of the population pressure.
The EPRDF is expected to win Sunday's elections, and the party has already said that five more years of EPRDF will mean a continuation of current policies. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
While the West Africa Ebola epidemic is believed to be winding down, the search for new treatments and vaccines is not. VOA's Jody Kapowa reports on a U.S.-Serbian effort to find an effective anti-Ebola drug.
Last September, there were some dire warnings that West Africa Ebola cases could eventually number between 500,000 and 1.5 million. Fortunately, that did not happen. But the biggest Ebola outbreak ever did infect about 27,000 people and killed more than 11,000. And after more than a year, it's still not over. While Liberia has been declared Ebola-free, Sierra Leone and Guinea have not. So health and government officials say better ways to prevent or contain another outbreak are very much needed. A number of vaccine trials continue, and different drugs are being tested. For example, the U.S. Defense Threat Reduction Agency and the Serbian Ministry of Science and Technical Development have provided funding to study a small class of molecules known as diazocrysines. Initial research shows that most of the mice that received one of three experimental compounds survived infection and did not show any side effects. One of the researchers is Bogdan Sholaya, professor of organic chemistry at the University of Belgrade.
There are several chemotypes, several classes of compounds which are actually today known to be active against Ebola. But from being active against Ebola to being a drug, it's a long, long way.
He says every step in researching a new drug is elementary.
Our compounds more or less behave good in mice. I mean, they cure some mice up to 90% as it is presented in this publication.
The findings appear in the journal ACS Infectious Diseases. But even though the results are very good, there's more that needs to be known. Are these compounds toxic? Sholaya says they are not. Can they cause changes in a patient's body, affecting DNA, for example, something called mutagenesis? The researcher says they know the answer, but cannot reveal it at this time.
The compounds are water-soluble as salts, and they can be administered in water solution. That is quite good, although they are usually administered in water DMSO mixture.
DMSO, dimethyl sulfoxide, is a byproduct of the wood industry and has been used as a solvent. It's been mixed with other substances to help them absorb faster. Shalaya says the goal is to have an Ebola drug that can be used the way HIV and malaria drugs are now being administered.
We want to have a drug which could be prophylactic and which could treat the animal which already got Ebola.
HIV and malaria drugs are now used to prevent infection and continue to be used if an infection has already occurred. Despite the initial and very encouraging success, the professor says the drug will not be on the market soon.
Average time from starting good results until market is about 10 years.
Shalaya and his colleagues are working with researchers at Fort Detrick in the U.S. state of Maryland. It's home to the Army Medical Research and Material Command and the former site of the U.S. Biological Weapons Program. Some of the most dangerous organisms to humans are studied there in underground labs. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The Islamic State group has claimed responsibility for the suicide bombing of a Shiite mosque in eastern Saudi Arabia today that killed at least 19 people and wounded dozens of others. The blast hit during afternoon prayers at the Imam Ali Mosque in Qatif, a governorate on the east coast of the predominantly Sunni Muslim kingdom. The state-run Saudi press agency confirmed the attack. White House spokesman Josh Earnest condemned the attack and called it indicative of extremist tactics. Pictures posted on social media show injured or dead victims in blood-soaked clothes being brought out of a building into ambulances parked outside. There is no confirmation of the number of casualties.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Hayes Wuhib in Washington. It's 27 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
On Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists, too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best. Right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. On Saturdays, tune in at 3:30 and 14:30 UTC, and on Sundays at 5:30 and 17:30 UTC. Or subscribe to the Encounter podcast. Just go to our homepage at voanews.com and click on podcasts. Also, we love to hear from you. Send an email to encounter@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/Carol Castiel VOA. That's Encounter on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Political demonstrations are expanding in Burundi. The UN says 30,000 people have fled intensified fighting in northern Mali over the past 2 weeks. And Kenyan officials say fighters from militant group Al-Shabaab attacked a village in northeastern Kenya last night. Coming up, we'll have music from Rwanda, and in our feature segment, a Nigerian university student's close encounter with Boko Haram. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Spuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Friday, Sunny.
Happy Friday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand a big football election kicks off your sports report.
Kim, incumbent Sepp Blatter is widely expected to be reelected to a fifth term next week as president of World Football's governing body, FIFA. The 79-year-old Blatter has led FIFA since 1998. His path to re-election was made a lot easier Thursday when two of his challengers, Luis Figo and Michael Van Praagh, dropped out. Former Portugal star Figo said FIFA has been a dictatorship under Blatter. In a statement, Figo said he refuses to go along with an election process that's designed, in his words, for the delivery of absolute power to one man, indicating Blatter. Meanwhile, at a news conference in Amsterdam, Dutch Football Association president Michael Van Praagh had this to say.
I am perfectly happy where I am right now. But I felt and still feel that FIFA needs to do better and that it is impossible that FIFA moves forward with its current leadership. This is why I decided to challenge Mr. Blatter. We need change in governance, in leadership, and in the culture of FIFA. We need to embrace criticism as an encouragement to be better.
Michael Van Praagh says he and Luis Figo are now backing Prince Ali bin Al Hussein of Jordan, the only remaining candidate in the May 29th FIFA presidential elections.
This campaign was always about the need to bring football forward and improve FIFA. And it still is. This is why the three of us sat down to discuss our chances. I have the support of many European countries and many more from all over the world, as we all do. So we decided to put our cards on the table, because we also concluded that we believe, as do practically all key players in the world, that one single candidate would have a bigger chance to win the election. Prince Ali Al Hussein convincingly demonstrated that at this moment in time, he is the candidate who has the biggest chance to challenge Sepp Blatter.
Prince Ali also spoke at the Amsterdam news conference. He said he believes Blatter has been in power long enough and it's time for new initiatives within FIFA.
Mr. Van Praagh and I share much common ground in our goals for FIFA. As President Van Praagh already mentioned to you, we work together to incorporate some of his policy proposals into my manifesto so that these important ideas were not lost to FIFA. I will be sending a revised copy of our manifesto to all National Association presidents immediately after this press conference. The new pledges, some of which Michael already mentioned, are a pledge to increase annual FAP payments to National Associations to $1 million per year, to be annually disbursed on January 1st every year. a pledge to publish the Garcia report in full as soon as possible, a commitment to developing a program that combats discrimination in all its forms, predicated on education programs and leadership by example.
The 39-year-old Prince Ali, a member of FIFA's executive committee, is regarded as a progressive candidate. Under his leadership, he was instrumental in persuading FIFA's rulemaking body to allow Muslim women footballers to wear the hijab or headscarf when they play. Joining us once again on the sunny side of sports is David Legg, our African football guru. Happy Friday, David.
Thank you, Sammy.
Togo is taking on a Belgian to guide its national team. How about an update for our Voice of America football fans?
Yes, Sammy. Tom Saint-Fiet, he's a man that's been around a bit. He's coached Ethiopia. More recently, he coached the South African club Free State Stars, but only lasted a couple of months before he got the sack. He now is seen as the savior of Togo. Togo are a team that regularly change coaches. Didier Six, a Frenchman, former star winger of the French national side, he took Togo to the 2013 Africa Cup of Nations quarterfinals, and his reward for being the first coach to achieve that feat with the Sparrowhawks was to get the sack. And the reason for that was he did not get on well with Emmanuel Adebayor, who, of course, is the star of the Togo team. And it's interesting that Adebayor also clashed with the Nigerian Stephen Keshi, head of the 2006 World Cup, and that led to Keshi being fired and replaced by the veteran German Otto Fischer. So golden rule number one, if you're coaching Togo, make sure you get on with Emmanuel Adebayor.
David, in African women's football, a prolific scorer from South Africa decides to hang up her boots. How about some details?
Yes, honey, this is amazing, really. Her name is Portia Medise. She's 31 years of age. And how about these statistics? She's played 117 international matches for South Africa. And believe it or believe it not, she has scored 102 goals. Now, that is Ronaldo Messi-style scoring. Not far short, Sonny, of a goal a game. An incredible achievement. She made her international debut in 2000. Not only has she played in Soweto in South Africa, but she's also played in Denmark. But she's decided to hang up her boots to concentrate on coaching. And, Sonny, I'm not going to be too brave or too intellectual when I predict that maybe in the not-too-distant future, the coach of the team known as Banyana Banyana will be one Portia Medise. I predict with a fair degree of certainty that she will coach the South African national women's team sooner rather than later. Fantastic achievement, and well done to Portia Medise. I repeat that amazing statistic, 117 international caps, 102 goals.
Let's give some kudos to new league champions in both Morocco and Rwanda. First, Morocco, David. How about an update?
Yes, Sonny. The champions there are Wydad Casablanca, and they did it in style thanks to a hat-trick by a Gabonese player by the name of Malik Bouvouna. It gave them a 3-0 win over Hassania Agadir, and that clinched the Moroccan title, which is undoubtedly one of the most competitive in Africa. And well done, too, to APR, that's the military club in Rwanda. They've clinched their 8th title in 10 years. A fantastic achievement. 15 victories, 7 draws, and 4 defeats. They scored 43 goals, and they conceded 18. And they finished ahead of AS Kigali. So for Wydad Casablanca supporters in Morocco and APR supporters in Rwanda, well done.
Well done indeed, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa.
Hi, I'm Shegu Adeyemi, coming to you all the way from Lagos, Nigeria. Weekends are for sports, Nightline Africa Sports, that is. And every Sunday, I'll give you highlights of the top sports stories of the past week and the weekend. Nightline Africa Sports from the Voice of America. Let the games begin.
We got the game on.
Game on, VOA sports fans. In the National Basketball Association playoffs, the Golden State Warriors held off the visiting Houston Rockets 99-98 to take a 2-0 lead in the Western Conference Finals. Golden State star Stephen Curry, the league most valuable player, and Houston star James Harden had a spectacular duel. Curry scored 33 points, while Harden scored a game-high 38 points, along with 10 rebounds and 9 assists. Now, Harden had a chance to win the game in the closing seconds, but he lost the ball after Curry and teammate Klay Thompson trapped him. Curry talked about the play after the game.
We talked about in the huddle, whether we scored or not, there's going to be nine seconds left on the clock. And whether they took a timeout, I don't know if they had one or not, but to be ready for the attacks. We kind of do that in a similar situation where, you know, if you get a stop, you push it and see what happens. So, you know, once HB went for the layup and missed and Draymond tried to get the rebound, it was kind of me and Klay and Andre on the other side retreating. And you saw James kind of put his head down. You knew he probably wasn't going to pass in that situation. So just to kind of stand him up before the three-point line, Klay funneled him right to me, and I was able to get a body on him. He threw it away to Dwight and threw it right back. And at that point, it's just don't let him get a shot off and try to be the hero. So we were able to get it done. And the key for us going to the next game is to protect our leads down the stretch of the fourth quarter, because we built up 7-8-point leads in the last two games and made it a little too drama-filled for us. So we want to figure that out as we go to Houston.
That's Stephen Curry of the Golden State Warriors, the National Basketball Association's league most valuable player. Houston will host Game 3 in the Western Conference Finals. That game will be played Saturday night, and Game 4 in the Best of 7 series will be Monday night, also in Houston, Texas. Meanwhile, the NBA's Eastern Conference Finals will resume later Friday night in the southern U.S. city of Atlanta, Georgia. The host Atlanta Hawks are hoping to come back from a 97-89 loss in Game 1 against LeBron James and the visiting Cleveland Cavaliers. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOASunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOASunnySports. I'm VOA Sunny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yehaeus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sunny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And today, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, a Nigerian university student's close encounter with Boko Haram. And next, South Africa is beginning a new love affair with vinyl records. But for some music, here is Kamachi of Rwanda with Rua Gaspo.
Gotcha. chumukara akajeri nyanzi wabo inyambo akareri zonga jimubirunga akareva na mama kuga wenda ati sindi yumbisha gaye jonza karuka
Rwanda's Kamichi with Rua Gaspo.
A close encounter with a violent Nigerian insurgent group, Boko Haram, could not stop 26-year-old Abubakar Umar from graduating last week at his university. Chris Stein reports from the city of Yola on Umar, who studied petroleum chemistry.
The scars on Abubakar Umar's arms distinguish him among this year's graduating class of the American University of Nigeria. A nighttime road trip from the campus in the northeastern city of Yola to the northern metropolis of Kano to visit family nearly turned deadly for Umar when he ran into a band of fighters from the Boko Haram insurgent group. The extremists have repeatedly bombed schools and killed students in their six-year quest to impose strict Islamic law. As Umar neared Podiskum, a city frequently targeted by Boko Haram in the war-torn Yobe state, other motorists warned him against taking his planned route because of the danger of attack. He had turned onto an alternate road when it happened.
And that was when I heard the gunshot. Actually, I slowed down because there was a pothole. The road was very, very bad. I think I was driving at about 60 or 40 kilometers per hour. And that was when I just saw these people coming out from the bush, and they were screaming, Allahu Akbar, and they were shooting at my car.
As Umar accelerated, a bullet hit his right arm. Further down the road, a second attack happened, and a second bullet hit his left arm. He pulled over only when he reached a town and changed clothes so he'd look like a local. He received no aid. An old man told him the town was under Boko Haram control and that anyone helping him would be killed. Eventually, a family allowed him to hide in their outhouse overnight. The next morning, the homeowner gave him a phone to call his friends to pick him up. But before he could leave, the Good Samaritan insisted he adopt a disguise.
If I'm going to go out the following morning, I have to disguise myself so as I will look like the same person that entered into his house. So I have to put muds and chicken dunks on my head. And I look like a madman with my shoes on my pockets. And that was how I was able to disguise myself.
At a commencement dinner last Friday, the university gave Umar an award for courage. He managed to complete his studies, even though he could not use his right hand for 14 weeks.
I should have died on that day. I could have died on that day because I lost so much blood. I passed out. There wasn't any medication that could treat me for the next morning. But somehow, I think the Lord kept me alive for a special reason. And one of those reasons is to be here to complete my degree.
Umar is not done with school. He wants to continue to get a master's degree in his field. Chris Stein for VOA News, Yola, Nigeria.
South Africa is beginning a new love affair with vinyl records after they were discontinued in the early 1990s in favor of CDs and more recently for electronic MP3 downloads. Vinyl record stores are opening in most major cities. Darren Taylor has more from Johannesburg.
Benji Moody flips through records inside his Johannesburg store, Vinyl Junkie. His vinyl albums are considerably more expensive than CDs or MP3s. Prices range from the equivalent of a couple of dollars to about $35 for a pristine copy of a classic rock album. Yet Moody, a veteran music consultant and record label boss, says his sales have spiked a hundredfold in the past year. He says it is young South Africans who are driving the vinyl explosion.
It's become hip to have records again. A lot of young people are the bulk of the people that buy vinyl now, people under 30 that were only being born when vinyl went into decline in the mid-80s.
A diamond stylus begins a recording inside the Record Mad shop in northern Johannesburg. Strapped for cash a few years ago, owner Kevin Stewart started selling his vinyl collection from home. Demand was so great that he saw an opportunity and opened the store.
I get a lot of young people coming in here and saying, my dad just gave me his record player, a bunch of records and a record player, so I'm, you know, expanding on that. So I think it was definitely driven by media and by reviewers and, you know, I think people just got really, really sick and tired of MP3s.
Moody says youngsters are discovering music their parents and even grandparents grew up with, and they want to listen to it just like their elders did on vinyl.
They're buying the classics. They're buying Zeppelin and the Doors and Hendrix and the Beatles and the Stones.
Do you like Modest Mouse?
I used to.
Because we've got the new one in of that.
An assistant helps a customer at Stewart's store.
I think a lot of people can still relate to records. You know, my dad had this, my mom had this. I grew up listening to Noddy on vinyl or Led Zeppelin or AC/DC or whatever it was.
According to Moody, increased demand for vinyl is linked to young South Africans realizing that the age of pop idols manufactured by TV isn't so great after all.
Young people are looking for something different. They're tired of being force-fed by radio, contemporary radio, and by record companies, force-fed a diet of people that all sound the same.
But at the heart of the vinyl upsurge, he says, is the fact that music simply sounds better and feels better on vinyl.
Vinyl to me sounds warmer and it has depth, it's got echo, it's got soul. Whereas digital is very clear, very precise, very Teutonic, but it's soulless. Vinyl is visceral, it's a visceral experience. You take it, you pick it up, it's something to look at. You can't look at an MP3.
Stewart says the rebirth of vinyl is resulting in a rebirth of music in South Africa.
People are connecting with music again in a way that, you know, our parents used to, our hippie fathers and our, you know, whatever, acid head mothers, you know.
Stewart does, however, expect the hype around vinyl to fade in the near future, but he adds that it has been resurrected forever and South Africans are all the better for it. Darren Taylor for VOA News, Johannesburg.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Peter Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Political turmoil continues in Burundi, with top government officials being dismissed following a short-lived effort by some military officers to take over the government. On May 17th, 5 days after the takeover attempt, President Pierre Nkurunziza issued a decree relieving the foreign, defense, and commerce ministers of their duties. Even as the president made his first public appearance in Bujumbura to show he was back in command, street protests continued there over his plans to run for a third term. Opponents say that violates the Constitution and the Arusha Agreement that was key to ending a deadly 13-year civil war. Announcement of President Nkurunziza's candidacy triggered street protests, which police tried to repress with water cannons, tear gas, and live ammunition. Estimates are that up to 20 people have been killed, hundreds injured, and hundreds detained over almost 4 weeks of demonstrations. Meanwhile, intimidation and violence by the ruling party's youth militia ahead of the planned May 26 legislative and June 26 presidential elections have caused tens of thousands of Burundians to flee to neighboring nations. The United States is deeply concerned by the potential for further bloodshed, including reports of retaliatory violence following the attempted seizure of power. We urge all parties to seek reconciliation and unity over revenge and retribution during this extremely tense period. We have acted to restrict travel for Burundian individuals who reportedly have committed human rights abuses and will consider additional measures against anyone who plans, participates in, or orders widespread or systematic discriminatory violence against the civilian population. The United States supports no effort by the military to take over power by unlawful means. We continue to believe that adhering to the compromises contained in the Arusha Agreement, including its presidential term limits provision, is key to returning stability and unity to Burundi. Thus, we hope that President Nkurunziza will weigh the best interests of his country and his legacy as he considers whether to continue his controversial bid for a third term. His candidacy will undermine Burundi's economic and democratic progress. Some international donors have already cut or suspended financial aid. The United States welcomes the mediation efforts by the United Nations and African Union and urges all Burundian stakeholders to participate constructively to find a peaceful, democratic resolution to the current crisis. We particularly welcome the announcement by the International Conference on the Great Lakes Region of the visit of the presidents of South Africa, Kenya, Uganda, and Tanzania to Bujumbura in the coming days to meet with all parties. Burundi has come far since the end of the last civil war that caused so many deaths and human suffering. The United States reiterates its strong support for the people of Burundi at this very difficult time.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here, only the best on VOA Africa.